Hey, everybody, welcome back to Crazy Money. This is your host, Paul. Today is a great day to be alive. You're alive. You're great. My guest this week is AJ Jacobs. He is the author of the new and amazing book, The Year of Living Constitutionally, One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Constitution's Original Meaning, in which AJ chronicles his year living as an 18th century citizen, or as close as he can come thereto, including writing his letters with quill and ink instead of doing email, carrying a musket around the Upper West Side of Manhattan while wearing colonial garb, and celebrating election days with cake and rum. Cake and rum, I said. Huzzay, huzzah, whatever. You might recall AJ's done these kinds of projects before. For example, in the first book that we spoke about on Crazy Money, Thanks a Thousand, he thanked 1,000 people that were involved in the making of his morning coffee. That was all about gratitude. In the year of living biblically, he lived according to the laws of the Bible, grew a beard, wouldn't sit on furniture that his wife had sat on while she was menstruating. Yes, that's in the Bible. And he tried to live it. What I love about AJ is he goes deep on these projects. He's living his quest to make his fellow citizens smarter, more aware, and more grateful. And he's a smart, funny dude who is just the right amount of kooky. That's who he is. He lives in New York City, very near where my family will soon live. In this conversation, AJ and I address originalism versus living constitutionalists' interpretation of the Constitution. Speaking of which, we talk about the way the Constitution is like a Rorschach test. People see what they want to see. And how elections used to be parties with beer and cake. We mentioned that above. The balance between individual rights and the common good. We talk about what are rights, where do they come from, and who decides which rights to prioritize. We also discuss the disproportionate power of the executive branch, and we do this in the context of current events, because that's what I do. I try to make what's going on out there relevant to these conversations that we have here on Crazy Money. Glad you're here. Please enjoy this conversation with AJ Jacobs. Who's your Wi-Fi provider before we even start?
My Wi-Fi provider at home is...
Are you happy with your Wi-Fi provider? This is where I am. We're closing on Wednesday, and all of a sudden I got to figure out.
Oh, my God. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So when does the move happen?
June 15th. June 30th, actually. We're going to live in an Airbnb for two weeks.
In New York?
No. In Atlanta. In Atlanta.
Oh, in Atlanta. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, that, I want to welcome you as soon as you're ready. I'll take you out for some Upper West Side coffee.
We're packing up the house on June 15th, going to an Airbnb. Stacy meets the movers up in New York and then comes back. And then I'm your neighbor, AJ.
So where are you exactly?
West 85th Street, Park Block.
Which one? Central Park West?
Yeah.
You really are my neighbor.
We're around the corner from you, from what I understand.
We are 2.5 blocks away. Do you have a dog?
Well, we have one, and we should have two soon after the time we're up there.
Oh, well, we're going to be seeing you out on the dog walking.
On the dog peeing place where the dog pees.
Yeah, that's exciting.
AJ, I don't know if you know this, but today marks your official induction into the Crazy Money Podcast Three Timers Club.
Wow. That is exciting.
How about that? Yes, the crowd goes wild.
Do I get cufflinks? Do I get a robe? What am I looking at?
Oh, I don't know. We'll present you some nominal award. You've got a closet full of crazy stuff after writing this book, so I'm sure your wife doesn't need to have any more memorabilia or souvenirs packed into an already tight apartment in New York City.
That is true. She's not a huge fan that I have not one but two muskets, she said. She doesn't think that's going to keep our apartment safe.
Now, you had the one musket that was like a replica, and then you got a real musket. Is that what happened?
That's right. I had one that was actually from the 1700s because I felt I needed to really commune with it. And then I got one that was, but that one you can't really shoot a lead ball out of because it might explode in your face. So then
that's
I had
a downside.
To get a
replica. That's a meaningful downside.
Yeah, seemed like a negative.
This year of living constitutionally is all part of AJ Jacobs' human experimental years and or projects. How did you come to this one?
This one came about because a couple of years ago, I started reading in the news every day another huge article about how this 230-year-old document, the Constitution, was having a massive effect on how I live my life and how millions of others do too. And I realized I knew nothing about it. I had never read the Constitution from top to bottom. And it's only 4 pages. They're big pages, but it is only...
It takes 20 minutes to read the Constitution.
That's right. 20 to 30 minutes. Yeah, I found.
Because I read it this weekend. And by the way...
You did.
I want to commend you on this because this is kind of an exercise in humility, right? Because you're admitting that you don't really understand the fundamental document on which our democracy, representative republic, whatever it is based. And we all talk about it as if we know exactly what rights it guarantees and the rules by which we all have to play. But in fact, when you read it, you go, oh, that's interesting, right?
Right. Well, 60% of Americans have never read it start to finish. I was in that 60%. I mean, honestly, I think it's more like 95%.
Sure.
But
except everybody that bought the Trump Bible, because you get a free constitution with the Trump Bible, AJ. I'm not sure you knew that.
I did not know that. Mm. I'd be interested in the percentage who read that too. But yeah, it was, I decided I want to learn and understand this document. And the way I like to understand things, as you know, is to do a deep dive and live it. That's what I did when I did the Year of Living Biblically several years ago, where I tried to understand the Bible by walking in the sandal steps of our forefathers. So the Ten Commandments and following every rule from the Ten Commandments to growing a huge beard to stoning adulterers, but with very small stones. I remember I didn't want to go to jail. So the same thing here. I decided I'm going to try to understand the original meaning by living it. So I'm going to carry a musket around New York. I'm going to I'm going to give up social media and write pamphlets with a quill pen. And I'm going to house soldiers or quarter soldiers, as is my Third Amendment right.
They cannot be thrust upon you, though, those soldiers.
Right. It was only with my consent, but I felt it was a nice thing to do.
Sure. And thus you found yourself picking up soldiers down by the wharves or picking up sailors down by the
wharves. Trying to.
By the docks.
It was right. Surprisingly hard. I got one soldier to come quarter. But I guess the two more serious goals in this, one was how should we interpret this document and how much should we focus on the original meaning and how much should it evolve and how can we save American democracy, which seems to be in an existential crisis. So that was part one. And part two was I always like to adopt the lifestyle to see what wisdom they might have had in the 18th century. Mm. Now, there's a lot that was terrible in the 18th century. You know, it was racist, it was sexist, homophobic. You had tobacco enemas to cure your stomach ills, which were literally blowing smoke up your butt. We don't want to go back. But are there elements of the mindset that, and I do think so, and we can talk about those, but things like virtue, things of like humility, slowing down your thinking instead of thumb texting and angry rant, all of these things make our lives a lot better right now.
See, this is why I look forward to being in New York City. Leaving Atlanta will be bittersweet, but to be your neighbor and to be able to see you walking down Columbus Avenue with a musket on your shoulder will be quite a treat. Or whatever the next
too.
Whatever you the next one is. One. I'd borrow. I'd walk with you, comrade soldier. You read the preamble to the Constitution, and I was like, oh, I thought that was the Declaration of Independence. And so I want to clarify which is which. And this is going to take just a minute. So I'm going to read just the first part of the Declaration of Independence. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume the power among the powers of the earth, the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. This is where it gets good. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's the Declaration of Independence. That was written in Congress July 4th, 1776. That's the charter, or that's the announcement. Here's the rule book. The Constitution, written in 1787, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, inure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense with the sea, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States. What are the similarities and dissimilarities of these documents?
Well, by the way, I love the preamble to the Constitution. It's one of my favorite, but I mean, it is a mission statement. It is like quite inspiring. And then there are other parts of the Constitution that are more baffling, even problematic. But they are very close cousins. They are the Declaration, as you said, is we are our own country. And the key part, as you said, is the rights, the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the Constitution's preamble is, here is why we're doing this. We want to protect our country. We want to ensure the general welfare. That's a phrase I love, general welfare. We don't use it enough. It means everyone's well-being. We got to think of everyone, the community, not just ourselves. So there's individual rights in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. That's big. But also our responsibilities to the community. So anyway, they're both important, and they both have been interpreted in wildly different ways. That's what's fascinating. It's very much a Rorschach test of what you believe.
Mm. And so we all see the Constitution for what we want it to be, as opposed to necessarily it being a perfect document whose meaning is self-evident.
Right.
To all for all generations.
Well, first of all, it's not perfect, and it wasn't meant to be perfect. They're typos, or whatever the 18th century equivalent
of. That was so funny, right? Yeah, they didn't have spell check, right?
They didn't have. I can forgive the unusual spelling, but things like Pennsylvania, the state, is spelled two different ways in the same four pages. There's no excuse for that. And they knew it wasn't perfect. George Washington wrote his nephew a couple of weeks after the convention and said, this is an imperfect document. And their hope was that it would become more perfect as we amended it. The problem was they made it so hard to amend. They didn't realize how difficult it would be to amend because they didn't foresee these two frozen opposing parties. So to amend the document, you need a majority in the Congress and the Senate and in the state legislature. So hard to get in our polarized. So that is a real crisis. And you can't amend the way we amend the Constitution without amending the Constitution. It's like a catch-22.
Mm. So there would have to be an amendment to change the process of adding amendments to the Constitution.
That's it.
Okay, so explain, what's the difference between articles and amendments? Why didn't they just write some of the amendments in as articles in the beginning?
Well, that is a great question. There are a few answers. One, it was the end of the summer and they were exhausted and they wanted to go home.
That's probably the best reason of all.
That's not a joke.
Steamy Philadelphia.
Exactly. Two, the Constitution is made up of three general parts. One, the preamble that's sort of like the mission statement. Then the articles, which are the rules for making rules, the rules for setting up government. And then the rights at the end, the Bill of Rights, which are all about individual rights. Now, another reason they didn't is because many of the founders thought it was so self-evident that we have these rights that you don't need to put them down. But the opponents of the Constitution were worried, this Constitution gives so much power to the federal government. We need to point out these individual rights. And actually, at the beginning, it was more about states. The states had the rights. It wasn't as much about individual rights.
But all powers not clearly dedicated, ordained, or whatever to the federal government are assumed to be powers that the state gets to enforce and or interpret.
Right. And I do think if you look at the Constitution is an interesting balance between the states and the federal government.
Right.
They're frenemies. And there were founding fathers, like at one point Hamilton, who said, wait, why do we have states? This is crazy. Why would people have two different governments? It's confusing. Let's just have the federal government get rid of the states. Why should morality or laws change because you move 50 miles north? And that's an interesting point. And that's one of the things I loved with this project is rethinking, why do we have these and what purpose do they serve? I came around to actually think there are some benefits to states. And the many of the great thinkers talk about states as the laboratories of democracy. So you try something out on a small scale, and if it works, then you can bring it larger. So that's how Obamacare started as a program in Massachusetts. And that was sort of, that was the test run. And then that was the beta. And then they went wide.
And now legal weed and, you know.
Exactly.
So there you go. And then abortion, right? Now, so.
Right. So it depends on which side of the aisle you are to whether this is, whether any particular issue is a good thing to start with states.
So let's use that as a jumping off point, because I want to use the Constitution and what you've learned as a lens through which to view some of the current events. And as you mentioned at the top of the conversation, every day it seems as if the Constitution is coming up as in the news cycle. And I don't know if that's different than it was 20 years ago, but it sure seems relevant in everything we're talking about right now. So abortion is probably the perfect states' rights issues, right? Amendment 10 gives all powers not specified to the federal government to the states. How do you interpret the way abortion is being adjudicated on a state-by-state basis, given the ruling of the Supreme Court last year?
Right. Well, that's a big question. But and first of all,
I'm not saying ask whether it's right or wrong, AJ. I'm saying
right. No. All right. Well, I'll give you how this project allowed me to view it. And that is part of this project. I want people to have a crash course in the Constitution. So the question is abortion guaranteed by the Constitution, which would mean that the nation, the federal government, guarantees it, so states have no say. So it would be legal everywhere. And that was the law under Roe v. Wade.
Mm-hmm.
But then that was overturned because the conservative bloc of the Supreme Court said, no, it's not in the Constitution. Now, what's interesting is it is not in the Constitution in that it doesn't say abortion is a guaranteed right. In fact, very few national constitutions around the world say that. I think France has recently added abortion as the right to abortion as a constitutional right. But is it an implied right?
Mm.
There are the actual written rights, and then there are the implied rights. So one argument was that it was implied under the right to privacy, which is itself implied. It never says in the Constitution, Americans have the right to privacy, but they have amendments such as you are safe from unreasonable searches and seizures. So that gives you a sense, oh, we have privacy. Or even the Third Amendment, the crazy one, which says you don't have to board soldiers in your house because your house is your home. So this is your private space. So this idea was taken by the liberal Supreme Court to mean that people, women, have a right to privacy, a sexual privacy, and that extended to abortion and it extended to birth control. But again, it is not explicitly stated in the Constitution. So what you have is people who are very, in this case, the conservatives are very narrow in their interpretation of what is in the Constitution. They are, in this sense, originalists, because they say, what were the original founding fathers? What did they mean when they wrote this? And they claim that they did not mean the right to abortion. They did not mean, even if you are a hardcore originalist like Clarence Thomas, he believes the 14th Amendment, which is famous because it says that you have equal protection under the law. This was passed right after the Civil War to give Black people the protections under the racist Southern regimes. But it didn't, in his opinion, the 14th Amendment does not talk about women. It was not meant, they were not saying, oh, women have equal protection under the law. It was all about Black men having equal protection under the law. So if you are a hardcore originalist, the Constitution does not guarantee discrimination based on gender or sex. And that would go to the States as well.
So Scalia was also an originalist, right?
He was one of the founders of modern day originalism.
So how do they justify that? Like, do they demonstrate reason or any flexibility in that? Because, I mean, it's clear that, well, it's not clear because it's not in the Constitution, but it seems that any reasonable person interpreting the Constitution today would say that, you know, women enjoy the same rights, freedoms as men. Now, maybe not pertaining to, in this case, healthcare, but in general, how do those guys, how do they interpret that? Like, how do they settle?
I find it in general, I love the concept of steel manning. Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah, it means it's the opposite of straw manning, right?
So, exactly. Yeah,
so make the argument for the opposing view.
Yes, let me try to steel man the originalist position, because there are reasonable, very smart people who adhere to it. It came about because the Supreme Court in the 1960s, under Warren, was very liberal and started giving decisions that were, there was the Roe v. Wade decision. There was a lot about the rights of accused criminals. But
that was also Brown v. Board as well was under that court.
And there
right?
was Brown v. Board. Now, originalists say that Brown v. Board does work under originalism, but well, that's a side note. The conservatives were like, wait a second. We didn't elect these guys. These are 9 appointed men, and they were men, and they're making these radical changes that America is not ready for, that the majority doesn't support. We've got to go back to the original text. The Constitution is like a recipe or a contract. So if you hire a contractor to build a bathroom, and then in the middle of it, he says, you know what, I'm going to add a sofa in the bathroom. I don't care. You know, we can change the contract midstream because we have better ideas now. And you're like, no, that's not true. So they said, you've got to look at the text. That is the first thing you look at, and you've got to stick to it. Otherwise, it's anarchy. And these 9 unelected people can do whatever they want. So that is sort of the steel manning of originalism. And to further steel man it, they aren't completely frozen in the past. So, for instance, they would say the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, originally, that was to prevent the constable from banging down your door and rifling through your desk with your quill pen written papers. Now, even conservatives say, no, that applies to your iPhone. That applies to digital information. But the question is, where do you draw the line? And those who believe in the opposite, or which is sometimes called living constitutionalism, mm-hmm. or pragmatism or pluralism, they say you don't have to just change what technologies it applies to. You also have to evolve your morals. So we have to realize and admit that gay people have the right to marry, because morals have evolved.
Congratulations, gay people. Welcome to the team. All right. It's interesting that you talked about how we assume a lot of rights are just, you know, inherent or granted by the Constitution. And you often hear people say, well, it's my right to do this, or it's my right to do that, where indeed the Constitution doesn't specifically guarantee many rights, the right to wear a hat, or as you point out quite humorously, the right to party for which one is implored to fight.
By the wise politicians in the Beastie Boys.
Correct. Right. Mike D for Congress. Does the right to free speech, coming back to the current events, does the right for free speech / to peaceably assemble, peaceably to assemble,
nice,
mean that I can block bridges or otherwise impede people's freedom?
Well, of course, like anything, it depends who you ask. If you go back to the original founding fathers, I believe they would say no. Most of them would say no. And what's fascinating is the idea of rights in today's America is very different from the idea of rights in the 1780s, and different from the idea of rights in many countries, like in European countries. Because often we see rights as a trump card, as absolute, as black and white. So, for instance, my right to free speech, that means I have the right to shout down someone who is trying to give a speech on stage because you can't stop me from speaking. Now, the founding fathers would balance your individual right against what's good for the society, what's good for the general welfare and the common good. And so they were much more open to censorship, for lack of a better word. There were state laws that against blasphemy, even, and against cursing, that were considered fine under the Constitution. And what I think is they would say, and other countries might say, yes, there is a right to free speech, but there's all these other rights as well. It's not just that we have a few rights and they're absolute. We have many rights and they're all conditional. So you have a right to free speech, but the audience has a right to hear this person. The person who's speaking has a right to make a living. And the theater has a right to put on shows that are uninterrupted. And you have to balance these rights. So it's like a negotiation of different rights to try to come out with what will be the best for society.
But so how do you interpret that? I mean, what's best for society is, as you say, this is a Rorschach test, right? So the way I think that people who are protesting and blocking bridges should be arrested, and they should be prepared to be arrested because they're committing civil disobedience. And yet we see these protesters just shocked that they're being removed from places where they are prohibiting other people to go about their lives. So who makes that call? The government, the local government, the federal government?
Well, the hope would be that it would be the people, that is the point of representative democracy, that if you have a governor who is too lenient and lets people shut down bridges, then you vote him out and you get in someone who is more law and order. That is the hope. But I do think, democracy is very complicated. And part of my book was how can we keep democracy? Because it's really depressing and distressing, the number of people who are saying, I'm okay with if this authoritarian figure comes in and just decides to ignore the rule of law.
Mm. I understand what you're saying. Speaking of that, does the Constitution say anything about the age and health of the president? What happens if the president is not all there mentally?
Well, there is an amendment about if the president is incapacitated, then what happens? But there's no upper age limit. There is a lower age limit.
Right.
You have to be 35. One interesting thing is 35 meant back then is very different than what 35 means now.
Sure.
Because, the average age was you died in your mid-40s, early 50s, unless you're Ben Franklin.
Right.
And so is that something that we should be changing? I don't know the answer to that.
One of the ways that we were supposed to protect ourselves from tyrants or just presidents with an itchy pen was the balance of powers. But you talk about how executive orders have become sort of rampant in most recent administrations. So should the president have the right to forgive student loans if he just decides they should be forgiven?
I think the president, both sides, Democratic and Republican, are out of control in terms of power. I mean, this is not the balance of power that the founders conceived. At the founders' time, Congress was number one. They were the first among equals. They were the ones closest to the people voting.
That's why they should be primary in the three parts of government, right? Executive, legislative, right. And judicial, right?
Yeah. What's fascinating, let me just go from president and then let me talk about the Supreme Court for just one minute.
Yeah.
But the president now is out of control. Like you said, George Washington was in office 8 years. He made eight executive orders. Eight. And now hundreds. Obama did hundreds. Trump did hundreds in his 4 years. The president has taken over war power. It was supposed to be split between Congress, was supposed to be able to declare war, and then the president sort of executed it.
So the last war we declared was World War II, right?
That is the last one, I believe. That's true.
So we had Korea, Vietnam. We had Iraq twice.
Right.
Grenada. all over the place, right?
Yeah. And even World War II was mostly driven by the president. The War of 1812, I think, was the last time Congress officially was the one that declared the war and drove the train. So it is, it's out of control. And I did, as part of my book, I was really trying to get into the rights of these original folks. And petitioning is a right. You can start a petition. That's in the First Amendment. So I started a petition to control the president, no matter if it's Democrat or Republican. And my idea was not original. My idea was stolen from the Founding Fathers at the Constitutional Convention. When James Wilson brought up the idea that there should be one president, a lot of the delegates were like, "What? Are you crazy? We just fought a bloody war to get rid of a king, and you now want one president to be in charge? No, that's terrible." They said, "Let's have a council of presidents, three presidents, 12 presidents." And it was a heated debate. In the end, the one president won because James Wilson convinced people it would be too much infighting. But the idea that it would be the fetus of monarchy, one of the delegates said, that's true. It has become more and more monarchical. And if Trump is elected, it is going to be, that fetus is going to be like an adolescent. It is really quite alarming.
In many ways. Hormonally, definitely.
Exactly. So, yeah, I think that that is out of control. And I also think the Supreme Court, the founders, if they came back, would be shocked. I mean, I think so. But of course, the experts I talk to also think so, which is perhaps more important because they spend their lives on it.
What's important about what you just said is that the executive orders, this is whether it's Democrat or Republican, the office itself has demonstrated too much power over the last few decades, right? At least.
Absolutely.
But regardless of who's in control, would you say that of the court as well, going back to the Warren Court?
Yes, absolutely.
So that the originalist thing was a good thing as well?
Well,
I mean that it was the pushback demonstrated that there is some balance of power there.
Exactly. I mean, I can understand the pushback. I mean, the problem was for liberals, it was sort of a, I don't know what the right metaphor is. They ate from the tree of knowledge. They saw, oh, well, the Supreme Court is passing all these wonderful civil rights initiatives. Mm-hmm. And so liberals were quite happy and they weren't worried about this Supreme Court's overreach. Then Nixon appoints a bunch of conservative justices and now the conservatives are in charge. And so the liberals have to live with this consequence that the justices have crazy power to change our lives, to say where we go to school, who we marry, what kind of health care we have access to. And I just think that is not a way to govern this country because they're unelected and they don't even have, there's a movement to have the justices have 18-year term limits. And I am all for that. That's the very basic thing that we should be doing. And both sides, I think, are on this train a little.
Yeah. Okay. So in reading the Constitution, not only did you inspire me to read it, and I was reminded that of what it was and, you know, what it contains. And it's so funny to, you know, like to think about the Electoral College and all that. When it hits the news, you can actually go and read the Constitution to see what it says. You don't have to wait to see what CNN or Fox News says about the Constitution. It's there to read if you want it. Here are some of the interesting things that I noted while reading it.
Oh, yeah. Let me hear.
The 18th Amendment is repealed by the 21st Amendment, and this is about prohibition. And so in general, what this says is that this document is, at least at the time, flexible enough to change and change back. Mm-hmm. That's pretty extraordinary, right?
Yeah. That is a great one, but it's very hard now to pass an amendment. I am very worried. The last amendment we passed was the 27th Amendment. And I have a story in there. I interviewed the guy who was the force behind making the 27th Amendment pass. And I'll just tell him very briefly, this is the amendment that says Congress cannot give itself a raise, an immediate raise. If they give you a raise, it's for the next Congress. Totally makes sense. Weirdly, this is one of the oldest proposed amendments. James Madison proposed it at the same time as free speech and right to bear arms. but it just never got enough states to sign off on it. So this kid, student at the University of Texas Austin, reads about it and realizes it's still alive. It's a zombie amendment. So he, in early 1990s, he goes on this campaign and he gets all of these states to sign off. And that is how we have the 27th Amendment. But even he says, well, 28 is going to be a bear. How are we going to do that with the divisiveness that we have? So that is what makes me worried. And this was a relatively non-controversial one. Like, right. Sure, makes sense.
Totally.
Congress, how are we going to pass another?
Who's going to vote against capping Congress's pay? I mean, nobody's going to vote against that, right?
Right. Maybe Congress.
But the most interesting part of that story to me was that his professor gave him, what, a C on that paper?
Oh, yeah. This was interesting. I think, I mean, he's very open that it was fueled partly by bitterness and rage because his professor, he wrote a paper saying we should restart this amendment. And the professor's like, this is garbage. And he's like, I'm going to show you. I'm going to pass an amendment. And he did. So it was actually very inspiring that one point of the book is that it takes a lot of people to make things happen. But paradoxically, one person can make a huge difference, like this guy.
Not to get sidelined by this, but the story, the legend behind FedEx, Federal Express, is that Fred Smith wrote a paper in business school about the business model for FedEx, and he got an F on it.
I did not know. That's
great.
That was
billions of dollars of market cap ago. So anyway, so we know that it's not as flexible as it once was. But there is other interesting stuff in here. I didn't realize that the Constitution allowed, in fact, encouraged the formation of or the granting of copyrights and patents, quote, to promote the progress of science and the useful arts. I didn't expect to see that in the Constitution.
I will say, yeah, they were very entrepreneurial. They were very pro-science and they were pro-capitalism. One thing that I find interesting about the whole debate is how flexible we should be with the Constitution is these guys were very entrepreneurial, and science is based on the idea of disproving something and making it better. So I do think their general mindset was that we need to change, we need to experiment. They were great experimenters. Jefferson was famous for saying we need a new constitution every 19 years.
Wow.
But yes, they were pro-science, pro-intellectual copyright. It was very vague what it meant, and that had to be, you know, the source of thousands of hours of congressional talks and laws and litigation. But that the general idea was, yes, we like having intellectual property.
And as you mentioned before, the Constitution was anti-monarchical. And if you think back, that makes a ton of sense because what are we doing? We're rebelling against the monarchy. We are establishing ourselves as independent government, independent democratic government. And therefore, they pointed out no titles of nobility would be awarded from the United States or by the states even, thus explaining why I'm not the Viscount of Georgia.
Well, you could be an honorary Viscount, maybe. But yes, you're absolutely right. They were very anti-monarchy because they had just fought this war and they were very scared. And you even the language at the time. So something like King's College was renamed Columbia College. King Street became Congress Street. King's Minuet Dance became Congress Minuet Dance. And I think we have backslid on this issue because we seem weirdly obsessed with monarchy here, whether it's the British royal family on the cover of People magazine every week, or it's just in our language, Burger King and Disney is all about to, I mean, I
there's
wrote,
nothing more regal than a Dairy Queen, AJ.
It's so true. That's where Queen Elizabeth can be found when she was alive. Yeah, so I actually wrote a letter to Disney saying it would be more American if they changed it so it was Disney Congress people or Congresswomen instead of Disney princesses. You know, let's democratize the Disney kingdom. I had not received an email back.
Iger's team didn't get back to you.
No, but I think they could use, they need some positive publicity.
But you did meet with Representative Ro Khanna.
Oh, I love this. Yes. Because a lot of the book, some of the book is a crash course in the Constitution, so you know you're more empowered when you read news stories. You know what people are talking about. But part of it was these adventures as I was trying to be the ultimate originalist. And one of the strangest parts of the Constitution is the Congress has the right to grant a letter of marque and reprisal. I never heard of it, but Google told me it's basically Congress can make you a legal pirate, a government sanctioned pirate, because in the Revolutionary War, there was very little Navy. So they outsourced it to private contractors. If you were a fisherman,
Dunkirk.
Yeah, it was very Dunkirk or Blackwater. Yeah. So if you had a fishing boat, you could apply to Congress and buy some guns, put it on your boat, go out and capture British ships, merchant ships, and you get to keep the booty. So if it was sherry, you look at the list of what they kept, like a lot, there was a lot of booze, but also weapons and clothing. And it was huge. We wouldn't have won the war without these sort of legal pirates because they captured about 2,000 British ships. Now, this is still in the Constitution. That's what's amazing about the Constitution. It still has these archaic parts. And I thought, well, we haven't had a legal pirate since 1815, but it's still there. So I met with Congress, Ro Khanna. He had asked me for fundraising. And I said, well, I do have a favor to ask of you. So I met with him and I gave him my application.
Some staffer got fired over this, AJ. You know that, right?
I hope not. Well, what I loved about Ro Khanna, he's a representative from California, pretty progressive. And he was very optimistic. He said, I handed him my application and he said, great, how can we make this happen? And then turned out he didn't know what I was asking for. So I explained to him what a letter of marque and reprisal was. He became a little less enthusiastic. He was a little like, wait a second. So you're going to go to the Taiwan Straits? Like, what's happening here? But he actually said he will bring it up with his colleagues. He liked the premise of my book of trying to go back to the original meaning to see how should we treat the Constitution. He was a constitutional scholar himself. He went to Yale Law School. So he was in favor of the project, although I'm still waiting for my letter of marque and reprisal. I'm still waiting.
I'm just guessing you may be waiting for a while. I got some buddies who have some pretty kick-ass boats and a lot of guns. When this comes back, they are ready. They are ready to...
That's a good point. Yeah, Silicon Valley people, I feel, have some nice yachts that would be good.
Well, they have yachts and they have bunkers in New Zealand and undisclosed locations in Middle America. All right, so what are the big lessons here, AJ, that you, if you had your wish for all the people in America to read this book, what do you want them to take away?
First, I hope they have a good time. I hope it's entertaining.
And I will vouch to, and maybe it's just because I have grown to know you and love you as a as a unique human being who is not shy about living his quirks and has a very indulgent family, or at least patient and kind and well-mannered family who values you enough to not throw you out when you do these crazy stunts, even if they do pay your rent and provide for their board. But I laughed a lot. I laughed a lot reading the book.
Thank you, Paul. Well, yes. So hopefully it also has some serious points and you'll feel, I hope the reader feels empowered afterwards so that they can read the news and have a better understanding of what's going on and feel empowered to act. Because part of the book was also, what can we take from the 18th century that would apply to our own society to make it better? And I have a few. I'll just list them super quickly, a couple of them. One is the idea of writing offline. I wrote with a quill, like most of the book I wrote with a quill, a goose quill and ink. I don't think you have to do that, but they were much more deliberate thinkers. So they weren't reacting in the moment with a bunch of angry emojis or acronyms. Like these, you would take your time, you would digest the news, which you read twice a week. You got your newspaper twice a week, and then you would think about the big picture and try to come up with solutions. There's the idea of thinking about responsibilities in addition to rights. That's sort of the idea of the virtue and the thinking about the general welfare. That is something I think I love individual rights, and that is a huge part of democracy, but I think that we've lost sight of the responsibilities that come with it. Sort of the ask not.
Give me an example of that. Yeah. Ask not, but well, what you can do for your country, but the other way around.
Many countries have sort of this required national service. It doesn't have to be military. Back then in the 1790s, it was military. You had to join the militia if you're an adult male. But now, you know, it could be AmeriCorps. It could be, and it doesn't have to be 2 years. It could be a month. Something to bind. We need a glue in this country to bind us together because we are splitting apart. And I believe that is one way to bind us together. I'll just give one other is the idea of being excited about democracy instead of cynical and nihilistic. And I bring this up because in the 1790s, Election Day was like a festival. It was like Halloween and Thanksgiving. People would go, there would be farmers market, music. It was like Coachella. You would go and there would be rum punch. There would be election cakes. Mm-hmm. There's a tradition of everyone would bake a cake with figs and dates. So maybe not the kind you want. But I loved the idea of election cakes so much that I started a trend. I started a movement to bring it back. So last election day, I got hundreds of people around the country to bake election cakes and bring them to the polls or to work with the sort of the motto, democracy is sweet. Let's remember that this is an amazing fact that we have some say in who we elect. We need to reform the process, but just having the process alone is something we need to treasure and try to keep because it is unusual in the history of society and it's unusual in the world and it's fragile and we can't take it for granted that it'll continue. We have to fight to keep it. So let's be festive. Let's have some cake and let's get rid of gerrymandering and many other structural problems, but let's start with some cake. And that is, that's the least we can do.
Cakes and then a third party. The cake party is what it should be.
There you go.
Well, I want you to know that I used your inspiration as an excuse to, I actually convinced my kids to bake a cake with me yesterday. Both as a celebration of democracy, but in a desperate attempt to do something with my children that didn't involve the television or the phone. And
lovely.
So we made a cake together and we each took responsibility for certain parts of it. And I forgot to put the milk in the batter. And so let me see if I share my screen with you.
It was a dry cake? How was it?
Hang on a second.
You can also email it to me.
I'll email it to you and show you what a disaster of an election cake I made. And it was all my fault. But I did get, I don't know, 45 minutes of uninterrupted time with my kids who are 13 and 14. And that's a cherished opportunity these days.
That is huge. Yeah, I did it with my kids too. And I recommend it. Yeah, it brings the nation together and brings the family together. I'm very pro cake.
AJ, thank you for your work. Thank you for your thought-provoking stunts of pure sincerity, I might add. Where can our listeners find out more about you, your book, and your work in general?
Well, thank you. My book, The Year of Living Constitutionally, is sold in where books are sold. I have a podcast called The Puzzler, a new Substack called Experimental Living with AJ Jacobs. So wherever you want to find me, I would love to hear from you. That's democracy.
That's right. Choose the way to petition AJ Jacobs. We'll put links to those in the show notes. AJ, best of luck with everything. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Paul.
All right. Well, it's always a pleasure to speak with AJ Jacobs, and it's a reward of this podcast that I get to know a guy like that and that I get to stay in touch with people like you, dear listener. Doesn't pay a lot, this podcasting, but it does have its rewards in relationships. And so I'm grateful for that. I'm also grateful for AJ. Here's why. I think that the reason I do this podcast is to help me figure out how to be me and hopefully to help you figure out how to be you in a way that's going to make you the most productive and healthy and happy person that you can be and contribute to the world in your own unique way that only you can do. And AJ does that like nobody else that I know. He brings his authentic curiosity, his authentic quirkiness, his authentic joy to these projects in a quest to make himself, but also everybody who reads his work smarter along the way. And who couldn't benefit from being smarter and more thoughtful these days, especially when it comes to politics? That's what I meant when I said in the conversation that, hey, you know, and all these conversations we're having around politics and everything you're reading in the news, all the conversations around the dinner table, it's really good to be able to just go read the Constitution and say, well, this is actually what it says. And yes, you can interpret it one way and I can interpret it another way. And that's okay. I'm always right, but it's okay for some other people to interpret things differently, you know? And so go read AJ's book. Go listen to his book like I did. Not to brag, but I have the Penguin Random House app on my phone, which only very important journalists get to have early access to the audiobooks. But it's going to be out. It's out this week. So you can read it. You can listen to it. And it's awful fun to hear AJ read it in his own unique voice inflections and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, thank you to AJ for doing that work. And next week, we will be back with mega podcaster Jordan Harbinger. It was really fun to talk to him, get to know him a little bit. So have a great few days. And in the meantime, Mike Carano, make me sound smart.